Hey, everybody, and welcome to the Android Central podcast for the week of March 16th, 2017. My name is Daniel Bader, and this week I'm joined by one extra person than normal. We have four lovely Android Central individuals, writers, reviewers,
persons
of interest on the podcast. From Seattle, Andrew Martinick, welcome back, sir.
Yeah, I actually do not know when I was last on the podcast, but I guess it would have been just the MWC podcast, which I don't count because those are just next levels of insanity.
It was a cluster is what it was.
Yes. I think somebody pointed out that we had multiple times where we said, we'll cut that out, and then we just didn't cut it out.
I don't blame Jim for not doing that because there were like six of them. From... Where are you, Russell? Baltimore-ish?
Yeah, nearabouts.
Nearabouts, somewhere that got hit with a lot of snow and sleet and ice in the last couple days.
We just got ice. It was as though ice fell from the sky. We didn't, like, there weren't even snowflakes. We got an inch of ice. It just grew up from the ground.
Sounds Russell like the Hawley, Northeast. Everybody. And from the mountainous, the hilly regions of West Virginia, returning to the podcast, Jerry Hildenbrandt.
Hey.
Up? How you feeling? You feeling a bit better?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I had that death flu thing last time.
Yeah, had the flu that was going around. So last week, we took a bit of a break from the phones, and Russell joined me, and we had Phil on to talk about cutting the cord. This week, we are... springing the cord right back to phones, and we're going to start with I think the most important phone until the next important phone, the LG G6. And today was the day, today being March 16th, that the phone went that all the carriers in the US announced pre-order information. So Andrew, we'll start with you because this is a fairly important flagship. It's the most important phone ever for LG, but I think it also stands to be a good counterpoint to the Galaxy S8 for the next few months. So take us through what this phone will cost and its sort of standout features.
So obviously around the world, it's going to be a little different, but we're talking about the US here. And LG just letting carriers dictate things a little bit. T-Mobile comes in at the bottom at $650, but that ranges all the way up to AT&T at $720 full price. And of course, those prices, you know, we look at it and say, hey, that's a difference of over 10%. That's pretty big. But all of the different deals and pricing schemes and all that crap that the carriers do means that those prices don't really get, you know, they don't really get shown off. I mean, everybody advertises their per month cost. You know, it's going to be $25 or $27 or $29 or whatever. Or you'll see AT&T say, oh, our price is only $22 a month. Yeah, but that's for 30 months instead of 24. So overall, I'm upset that there are a couple that, you know, push this above $700 just because it's going to lose its competitive advantage against the impending Galaxy S8. Obviously, these are going to go on sale. I mean, they're going to be up for pre-order starting tomorrow for the most part. And is it Verizon that's going a little early? March 30th?
It is.
They're going to actually
be
on sale.
They did the same thing with the V20. But I don't know whether it'll be in stores. It'll at least be online on March 30th. And then the rest of the carriers will release it on April 7th.
And they do a good job usually when you pre-order, you know, they're going to have it arrive the day that it's available, quote unquote, whether on, you know, online in store. But either way, I think it's a little, we were just talking before we got going here, and I want to bring it up that, you know, the Galaxy S8 is probably going to cost, the smaller one is probably going to cost similarly to this. And that's going to be really hard for LG to fight the marketing mindshare behemoth that is Samsung at the same price. Now, of course, the S8 Plus is probably going to be $100 to $150 more, but LG is not making, you know, they have the V20 to compare to that, and that's going to be a losing battle for LG. So this is really their chance, especially with how good the G6 is. I mean, we've talked about it, right, you know, from the moment that we had it, at MWC that best phone that LG's ever made. It's made really well. The processor is fine. Don't worry about the 821. Like, the performance is great. The cameras are really, really, really good. I don't know if you guys talked about that at all in the previous two podcasts, but man, the cameras on the G6 are really good. The problem is that people don't know about all that stuff inherently. You know, they come in and they see T-Mobile's going to have it for $650, but they're also going to have some crazy incentives to buy a Galaxy S8 too. And, you know, that's going to make it cheaper overall, if not just the same price, to get a Galaxy S8. And they say, yeah, well, I already had a Samsung phone. I'll just get the next Samsung phone. And that's going to hurt. Now, what was LG's choice, right? Could they undercut by $200 and just lose a ton of money? No, they can't do that. So it's good to at least see them get out what we're assuming is, what, guys, 3 weeks ahead of the Galaxy S8?
Yeah, sounds about right.
So, you know, that makes a difference a little bit, but, you know, Samsung will make up the difference in sales in, you know, a week.
So, Jerry, I wanted to ask, because all four carriers, and it seems like practically anybody in the U.S. buying a G6 is eligible for this free Google Home promo. And mm-hmm. I'm just wondering, you know, Google and LG have always had a fairly close relationship. What is going on here behind the scenes? Is this LG just buying 3 or 4 million Google Homes, or however many G6s they hope to sell, and then just giving them? Or is Google actually playing a role in here somewhere?
I'm sure Google is, if not directly supplying the things, they're making it really cheap for LG to do so, because both companies benefit. You've got Assistant on the phone, and you'll have Google Home to play with Assistant even more. That's going to catch your interest if that's your thing. If that's the kind of thing you like, you're going to enjoy having both. So Google has to see the value there. And you, like you said, Google and LG are tight, and Google isn't afraid to spend money in lots of ways we don't understand.
But Russell, I'm going to go a bit deeper here. Is there a vested interest in Google putting its money or its support behind the G6 in order to make the phone more attractive in the run-up to the GS8 release?
I think any effort by Google, you know, as kind of limited and veiled as it may be, to ensure that Samsung, you know, isn't 100% of the market, is a good idea.
So, yeah, I mean, I agree with you. There's obviously, you know, but it's interesting that why would Google, if it does play a part in this, and this is very simplistic, but why not give away a Google Home with the purchase of a Pixel? Why put its weight behind a G6?
Because the G6 is going to sell 300% more than the Pixel will ever dream of selling.
Okay, so that now we're on to something.
Yeah.
I mean, you think about it, those phones are available at all of the carrier stores, right? And the Pixel wasn't and isn't going to be. I mean, they made a deal with just Verizon. And even if they are able to extend that this year with the Pixel 2, that's still a lot of time where Google Home, you know, needs that growth period, you know, to kind of span that to the Pixel 2. So I wouldn't be surprised if we see something similar later on. But the, you know, by the time Google Home had came out and was at a point where Google felt like it was, you know, something worth promoting, the Pixel wasn't the hot phone people were buying anymore. So attaching that rider to the Pixel, even if enough people were going to buy it when it came out, it certainly has died off now.
Well, I mean, I think that the other part of that, though, is you mentioned it only being available in one carrier. Also, you can say that it was the hot phone 3 months ago, but there are some people that placed their order for their Pixel 5 weeks ago that will get it the same time as people that buy the G6. I mean, you still can't go buy the Pixel that you want most times when you go to the Google store.
You have to go to Verizon and get a 32 gigabyte one in black if you want one today.
So, I mean, that's just more to your point, Russell, that this, and Jerry, this makes more sense to have a partnership with a more mainstream, you know, for all the bad parts of LG being, you know, caving to the carriers and being more, you know, general market. That's who Google wants the Google Assistant to be in the hands of with Google Home and the and of course the expansion of Assistant on the phone. So they want the biggest market possible for that. And you know, that comes from partnering with somebody like LG. They're not going to cut the same kind of deal with Samsung. Samsung has its own initiatives that it wants to push.
Right. If you Google Assistant depends on a type of neural network for it to progress and get better, where it's got a huge pool of data it can pull from and try to sort out what's important. There's a very, you know, Google really needs as many people to use this as can, you know, the more people that use it, the better it gets, and then more people will want to use it, and then it continues to get better, is what I'm trying to say. And Google knows this, and they know that right now it's not the best thing. You know, an Echo is better, let's be honest. You plug in an Echo, it seems like it does more. It's cooler. But that's not...
It has 10,000 skills, right, whatever the hell that means.
Right, but Google has your life, and this assistant can tap into your life and your life experiences, and they can look at my life experiences and Andrew's life experiences and see the things that we, you know, do the same way and that other people do, and it can learn from that kind of stuff. But to do that, it needs to have a bunch of people using it. But, so it's really important.
Let's diverge for a second then to talk a little bit about the Google Assistant, because obviously it's on the Home, and this push to get the Google Home into more living rooms is great. But Google just did something far bigger and more consequential. It launched Google Assistant on hundreds of millions of Android phones running Marshmallow and Nougat. So that is going to improve that neural net and make and help the machine learning algorithms figure out what people want and the kinds of answers people expect far better than the Google Home, right?
Yes, but the difference, they both serve different parts of the market, and that the Google Home has, first of all, it has much lower setup requirements, right? You buy the thing, it only costs $129. You know, you don't have to upgrade any software or anything. You take it out of the box, it's an appliance. You plug it in and it works. It also has the second advantage of being a physical thing that's really hard to ignore because it's just sitting there listening all the time. Your phone may be in your pocket or in the other room or in a bag or on silent or whatever. It's not available all the time that you're at home. The Google Home is just sitting there available, and it's a visual reminder that you have Google Assistant. I mean, I've used the Pixel XL since the moment it was announced. A lot of you guys used the Pixels for just as much or more time than me. You forget that the Google Assistant is there because you have lots of other things that you're doing on your phone. Assistant is just a feature of your phone. Assistant is Google Home, 100%. And so both of those things can coexist. And I agree that scale-wise, having Assistant install on every single phone running Marshmallow and later is huge, absolutely massive. But that doesn't mean that Google Home doesn't have a place too.
It's also important to point out that while Amazon does more with the Echo right now, and that's certainly not going to change anytime soon because they've been working on it for several years now, Google does several things just from a functionality standpoint way better with Assistant. You know, every single thing in Google Assistant is treated as the same level of command, whether it's third party or not. And that's something that the Echo just plain doesn't do. A third party service comes in, it gets, you know, the command structure changes. The voice, you know, it becomes less intuitive the way that you give that a command, because it's no longer, hey Google, how do I do this? It's, hey Google, tell this other thing to tell me how I do this. And it ends up being, you know, really kind of confusing when you start tying in these third party services, because the commands are not all the same. And that was one of the biggest things that I took away from the Google Home announcement, is that, you know, as Google adds third-party services, and when they finally open it up so that anybody can just click a button and push a service, that they're all treated exactly the same. The command structure is exactly the same. And that's really important for this whole, you know, natural language processing thing, as you're, you know, talking to a thing and expecting a result, that consistency is really important.
So one other thing that Google Assistant is going to be and is getting good at is advertising. This is something that I don't think we really took into account when we started reporting on Google Home, but obviously Google being one of the biggest advertising providers on the internet, it was going to do this at some point. Today, being March 16th, the movie Beauty and the Beast comes out in theaters. It's a big deal for Disney. It's a big deal for Disney's investors. If you ask Google Home or Google Assistant, what's my day like? It will say the weather is good, the traffic is bad, and by the way, Beauty and the Beast opens today. And that in this version of the story, Belle is the inventor instead of Maurice. That rings true if you ask me. For some more movie fun, ask me something about Belle.
Holy crap.
Can you hear the sacks of money hitting the floor?
So this is the first
somewhere in Disney.
This is the first ad that Google has rolled out to Assistant. And at this point, you cannot opt out. It's just part of the My Day feature. But you can extrapolate from this one experience to see exactly what Google is going to allow partner brands to do. And that's going to make them a boatload of money.
It's also following immediately in the footsteps of Amazon, who has done the same thing with Echo twice already.
Right. And Google has done this occasionally for Google's done it for Google Maps. They partner with, for example, Kong Island, I think it was called, opened last week. And you could search for Kong Island on Google Maps, which was basically just a made up island in the Pacific.
And how dare you say that Skull Island was made up? It's a real place that you can go to.
My bad. Have you been there? Is it lava-rific?
I'm there right
now. It's in Baltimore.
Oh, that's why it took so long. Okay, got it. So yeah, I mean, this is something that really this is a part of the story that we really haven't touched on, but it's interesting, right?
Yeah, I like it because I think that Google is a company that's going to find a way to get that in there in a way that Jerry doesn't hate it. Because what you do, I haven't tried. As soon as we're done, I'm going to ask this thing about Beauty and the Beast.
You should do it live on the podcast.
Well,
I don't want
you all to hear what the rest of my day might be. Oh. I don't know what's in there. I thought of that.
It's 9 different entries for playing Jerry's favorite game on his phone.
It could be. I mean, I don't know what's in there. I don't know what my calendar's like. And it's more of an embargo thing that I can't talk about than anything really good.
A tease.
But I don't like what you described to me. That's a waste of my time when I want to find out about my day and I have to listen to 10 seconds of a movie that I don't care about. But it's also a way that it ties in kind of naturally. And it's like, oh, by the way, check this out, dude. If Google can refine that and make it so people like me, because I'm not the only one that's going to hate that the way that's done. But if they can find a way to make it so, even though I don't care about Beauty and the Beast, I don't hate the way that they tell me about it, they win.
Well, I mean, to me, it comes across as sort of like a podcast ad.
Yeah.
You know, you listen to a show. In this case, it's an on-demand show that happens to last 20 seconds, but as a part of it, the show is brought to you by X brand. I mean, it's something that people have been dealing with in every medium for years. So this one makes sense. It's just that I just think there's a disconnect between expectation and the actual reality. People don't expect or haven't expected ads from these kinds of accessories or consoles yet.
And
it's also important that the My Day function in Google Home has a great big button that says my day summary ends with, and there's an option for nothing additional.
Mm-hmm. Ooh, oh, interesting.
Okay. What's highlighted by default is news, and so you can actually grab stuff from the news tab, and you can choose what content goes in there. And so this was what's happening here. This was added to the news part there that you play at the end, but it's something that can be disabled immediately if it's something that you feel like you don't like.
Yeah. Well, that's good. I mean, that's something that we didn't know. So this is obviously a sort of a breaking story as we're telling this to you. So you may know more by the time the podcast is out. But I still find that fascinating, and I'm sure we'll learn more about it. So let's maneuver back to the G6, Andrew, because I want to talk a little bit about the phone itself. We did speak on it at MWC, but it was a bit of a ramshackle podcast, and our review. Our review wasn't up yet. So you've had time with it. You love the camera. You think that it's got a camera that matches or beats, in some cases, the Pixel. So tell us about it.
Yeah. I mean, I think I have to start with that camera part because I mentioned it earlier that it was extremely surprising to me that the G6 could match or beat the Pixel, because, you know, we've all been gushing about the Pixel's camera because it's still really, really great. And HDR Plus does some amazing things and even makes, you know, images turn out that you would never expect to be able to turn out. But we didn't expect that with the G6 because it kind of has an older type of sensor and smaller pixels. And of course, it has OIS. Sorry?
We should have. Looking back, It's the 821 that's doing it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, so they were able to get a lot out of this sensor because, you know, don't judge a book by its cover and yada, 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 whatever your mom told you growing up. But it takes daylight photos that are brighter and more colorful than the Pixel. The Pixel is very well known for being true to life and muted. And you can argue about whether or not being true to life is the true goal of photography, or, you know, whatever. Truth is, most people just want a photo that's looks the way their eyes see it. And then some. They don't want something that is approaching what their eyes see. So they want to see bright and vibrant. And the G6 absolutely does that. And then at night, it also reproduces things properly with just subtle hints of, you know, extra brightness here and there, whereas the Pixel kind of goes too far in the other direction and, like I said, will kind of create scenes that aren't there. So it matches the Pixel in terms of quality, which means that, you know, Samsung's really going to have to step it up with the GS8 because I think both of these cameras are better than what's in the GS7. So if Samsung can't up their processing and make it really happen with the GS8, then they're going to be a little bit behind the G6. And then the G6 has this wide-angle camera that I know Jerry isn't a fan of because it's kind of a distorted fisheye look, but I know that Daniel is a huge fan of it, and so am I. I absolutely love taking photos with the wide-angle camera, and now it takes photos that are near identical to the standard camera because they're using the same sensor, which is awesome. The camera experience is excellent. The hardware itself, I like how narrow it is. I like how much smaller it is than other phones. Yes, I know that the screen is actually smaller than a 5.7-inch phone that's a different aspect ratio, but I don't care. I just want the phone to be narrower and easier to use, which it is. And the performance is also good. I mean, the only bad thing that I can say about it is that LG software is still a little heavy in terms of what it wants to do by default. You know, you have duplicative apps from Google and LG. You have this squircle icon thing that you have to go in and turn off. You have some animations that are a bit much, and you have to really just switch launchers, switch keyboards, you know, that kind of stuff. But overall, I'm extremely happy with it. Like I said, from the top, it's LG's best phone, you know, bar none. And not just, you know, in the way that things get better every year, but relative to the competition, it's LG's best phone, I think. And that's saying a lot because I think the G2, G3, and G4, well, mostly the G2 and G4 were really solid phones compared to the competition. This is right up there. And, you know, when it comes out and can beat the, you know, can beat the Pixel's camera in some respects and still have, you know, good battery life, good performance. You know, I like the tall screen. That's a lot of praise. And it means that the Galaxy S8 for me, obviously not in the wider market, but for me, is going to have to do a lot to catch up.
So this is getting a bit nerdy, but I do want to touch on something. The G6 has a sensor that's almost 2 years old. Camera sensor. It's the same sensor mm-hmm. in both the regular lens and the wide angle lens, but it's the same 13 megapixel sensor. And this one was in phones from the Xiaomi Mi 5 to a couple of sort of mid-range devices that didn't ever get released in the West. But this is not from a camera sensor perspective, not really a notable module. It's just good, no. You know? But from, as Jerry said, the Snapdragon A21 seems to have such a good ISP, image signal processor, and such range in terms of its ability to integrate, phase detection autofocus, laser autofocus. It works with the optical image stabilization module really well. That LG has eked out some incredible photos from here. So Jerry, can you touch on that a little bit? The fact that a lot of phones release over the past few years, the sensors were not being fully utilized. I mean, we just have to look at Sony as an example of that.
Yep.
And this kind of gives me hope that even though the advancement, the physical size or the physical, the size of the pixels may not actually increase very much over the next few years because of physics, the software and the associated connection between the sensors and the motherboard will improve so much that we'll be able to get better photos from it.
Yeah. The G6 proves, that there's a point of diminishing return in the sensor, at least right now. The G6 sensor is not as good as the sensor on the Pixel. It's just not. But the pictures are. So you don't necessarily need a better sensor than what LG is offering. I'm sure LG is using that sensor because they needed two, and it's a different arrangement than anybody else is using.
Yep.
But that the sensor really only just collects points of light. As long as it can collect the right points of light in the right order and in the right places, the ISP in the Snapdragon A21 is doing all the magic with those points. It's the geometry that changes the edge and makes edge detection. That's for your sharpness. And then what is white? That's a thing that white really isn't white. And the ISP knows how to adjust for that to give lifelike colors or colors that we like. Andrew hit a really big point. We don't like colors that look real when they're on a screen. We want things on a screen to be brighter and more saturated.
And if you email us and say, I love the most natural colors, no, don't. We've done so much research and given the entire audience the ability to vote, and overwhelmingly, people who look at photos choose the more vibrant and the less realistic. It's a thing. It's not a bad thing. Like, don't be upset by it, but it is a thing that happens.
We have evidence of that. We did a blind photo test last year.
Oh, yeah.
And the Galaxy S7 won by a landslide.
It was embarrassingly overwhelming.
Well, you don't need any. If you go to your local Best Buy and talk to the guy that sells TVs and ask him about Samsung's demo mode and why is it blue, and he will give you all the evidence you need. We don't like the color white. Our eyes like blue, to a shade of blue that makes us think it's white. And there's a whole bunch of science behind it. But Qualcomm and in their ISP and their partners, they don't say who their partners were, but I've got a gut feeling it was Sony, was one of their partners. Why not get the people that make the lenses that everybody uses to work with you, right? They have figured out how to duplicate exactly what we want instead of trying to recreate what the lens actually sees. So the lens isn't quite as important now. Samsung, that's another thing Andrew nailed. Samsung has their work cut out for them because their phones that have the Exynos processor have usually been just as good or better in the video and audio departments. This time that might not be the case, and that's not a good thing. Samsung really had to work hard to get their chip and their image processor to work this good. They're capable of it. Samsung's one of the best companies in the world when it comes to this kind of thing. But Qualcomm did it first, and now Samsung is playing catch up with half their market.
Okay, so I think that's a good opportunity to move over to talk a little bit about the Galaxy S8, but I do want to bridge it a little bit. What can, because we've heard that the Galaxy S8 will have a single camera setup, that the research done into a dual camera setup for whatever reason didn't amount to something good enough to put in a finished product, so we may have to wait until the next Note this fall. So we think the Galaxy S8 will have a 12 megapixel sensor, single sensor setup, likely with an f1.7 lens, because once you get wider than that, it just distorts everything and it just looks weird. So I think we've kind of brushed up against the limit of that physically. What can the Galaxy S8 do to improve on the camera capabilities? We know that the Snapdragon 35 has an improved ISP over even the A21. So what is that going to look like?
I mean, I think that the interesting thing is that a lot of the things that Samsung hung their hat on, which was great low light performance, being able to launch the camera instantly with the double press of the home button, and just general really punchy colors, and which tended to be a little on the warmer side as well. That was awesome with the Galaxy S6. Still pretty good with the Galaxy S7, but those are things that other cameras do. And in the mainstream, I mean, the G6 can absolutely do all of those things. The Pixel can absolutely do all those things since it sped up its performance. So those kind of things, those are just givens now. They have to step it up, and I don't think that it's necessarily going to be in, you know, software, you know, all of these different shooting modes and filters and crap like that. You know, yes, those are there, but people don't use those as a, you know, a measuring stick for how good the camera right. is. They're going to have to come up with some other kind of, I hate to say gimmick, but it's going to have to be some kind of a gimmick. I mean, we had the leak today that they may be doing 1,000 frame per second slow motion video. That's something that they can say is a legitimate feature. Like it takes yeah. slow motion video 4 times slower than the Galaxy S7 and 8 times slower than the iPhone and most other phones that do 120 frames per second. But in terms of the images, it looks like we're going to be looking at very similar image quality if they turn, you know, they end up using the same type of sensor and lens that they're using last year, which, like I said, the Galaxy S7 still takes great photos. It doesn't stand up to what the Pixel and the G6 can do. So they have to bring that level up, add some kind of a gimmick or two, because all of the other stuff that they hung their hat on in terms of speed and low light performance, like those are available elsewhere. That's not something that they can say they're, you know, is exclusive to the Galaxy S8.
I also want to see some changes to just, you know, the stuff around the camera. You know, give me a more impressive auto stabilization, you know, setup. You know, give me a rapid fire that doesn't have blurry shots in the middle.
Yes.
You know, these are things that, you know, it's Samsung has done a really great job over the last couple of years saying, you know, we've taken these core concepts and we've brought them up so that they're really good. But there's always been some weird struggling around the details, and we don't talk about that quite as much as we maybe should, because the core photo itself is often very good. But when we look at things like, you know, motion in various situations, or you know, being able to use things like slow motion, you know, in more than just a standing still environment or something like that, these cameras are typically, you know, they typically stumble a little bit in those environments. And so that's where I think I would be most impressed to see Samsung, like, really stand up, you know, like Andrew said with the slow motion, like being able to say our slow motion is, you know, X many times better than our previous generation, but do that with all of these kind of core details around the camera. And I think that would be really impressive.
And we know that Google and Apple are working on just exactly that, ways to use the software to make the experience better. So you don't have blurry shots in your burst mode, or your video is stabilized and doesn't swing all around. So if anything that Apple and Google can do, Samsung can do maybe even better.
Yeah, I mean, I have an example from the G6. Like, I agree with Andrew. The G6 takes great photos. But I was at a dog park, and dogs
as
move
you
and
are
they move.
Most times of the day nowadays.
I do spend a lot of time at the dog park.
go on.
And I was, you know, it was about 4 p.m. It was a sunny day, and I was taking a photo of a dog, and the dog was moving, but it wasn't like it was running. And the photo was blurry. And I looked at the EXIF data, and it was 1 over 20. So the shutter speed was 1/20th of a second, and it was ISO 800. And I kept thinking to myself, like, this is a daylight photo. This is a photo that should not have that the ISP should not have chosen those settings for that particular shot. It could have been even 1 over 100 and kept the ISO at 800 and still been a very well-lit photo. And these are the kinds of decisions that your camera needs to make every time you take a shot, a photo. And it needs to do so intelligently, consistently. And that's the kind of stuff that Russell was saying. It's not smart enough all the time. And it still gives you, for every great photo you take, in tough situations, you may still get three or four crappy ones that you can't use. And I want those numbers to go down. I want the Galaxy S8 just to give me a great photo every time and know that if there's a dog in the frame, regardless of, you know, how high the ISO needs to be, I mean, not up until a point where it's super grainy, but increase the ISO to a point where you get a photo that's not blurry. And I don't know whether we're there yet.
And that's all up to the people that are writing the camera application. That ISP can do amazing things, but you have to tell it to do it.
Right.
So, I just hope that we don't get, attempts to clone Apple features from the, you know, their most recent launch. I've used that, the 7, and I've used it for a long time. I can count on one hand how many times I've used that second camera.
The portrait mode.
The portrait mode or you know, the second camera to zoom in on stuff. You know, it's just, you know, I take photos using that iPhone the same way that I take photos using my Pixel or you know, my S7 or anything. I pull my phone out and take that single shot as close as as quickly as I can. I don't mess around with any of these other features. You know, my goal is to capture that moment as quickly as possible. And I it would really disappoint me if Samsung went, hey, now we can zoom in, you know, 2x optical as well, because I honestly don't think too many people use it.
You know, you can drill that lens out and plug a pair of headphones in the hole.
You're so ridiculous. I mean, that's a good point. The interesting thing about the iPhone setup, I guess, is that ASUS with the Zenfone 3 Zoom, and Andrew played with this at CES, is basically doing that same thing. I mean, almost identical,
right?
I
saw that camera too.
Yeah, it's very similar.
There's no, like, they try really hard to be like, no, this is just a new way of doing the thing we were doing before. No, you are straight up doing what Apple was doing. And it's really funny that their details, like, they zoom in 2.1x instead of 2x. When they're doing the software comparison for stuff, it's so ridiculous that they have these just slight, numerical advantages over what Apple is doing with theirs. When I sat the two phones side by side, it was so ridiculous.
Okay, so I get that it's not a feature that you may use a lot, but at the same time, I do think that we need to solve for optical zoom on phones. And Derek, who was not here, but was on the MWC podcast, he got to demo a solution by Oppo that basically takes an optical lens but embeds it horizontally in the phone. So what it does is it uses a series of mirrors to lengthen the lends itself to something like, I think it's 70 millimeters equivalent, which is a fairly decent length for any lens, never mind just a smartphone lens. And there's no protrusion on the back of the phone because the lens itself is actually embedded in the phone. And that's a really interesting solution, I think. That's something that not everybody is doing. And Oppo, I think, owns a patent, so I hope it doesn't keep it to itself. But this is a solution that I think could work. And it really does solve the issue of we tend to, you know, use pinch to zoom on phone cameras without realizing that all we're doing is just cropping an image. Or we do realize it and we don't care.
It hurts me every single time I see someone doing it, so...
Dan, what you just described to me made a phone so expensive that I'm not going to buy it because of a feature I don't want. This has already been solved. Sony and Motorola solved this. You make something that you snap to the back of a phone that has actual electronics and an actual lens that moves. A real camera lens.
People don't want to do that.
But
I mean,
but
we have a long list of things that people don't want to do, the end of the day.
But the people that want optical zoom on their phone are the people that will want to do that. The rest of us don't want it because we don't care.
People
that want optical zoom on their phone are the people that stand in front of Niagara Falls with an iPad and pinch to zoom until they can see up someone's nose.
Yes, they don't want optical zoom. They want to be able to pinch and zoom, but then automatically... the photo is the same quality.
They're not interested in the mechanics. They're interested in getting the picture closer.
Yeah, they want an enhanced button.
Right, and perhaps at some point this crazy Oppo thing, which is very interesting from an engineering standpoint, could be something that is a somewhat cheaper component and is an option that makes it of similar price to installing two complete camera sensors and lenses and, you know, that whole assembly. I mean, we know from the talking to LG about the G6, it is not cheap nor easy to put two identical sensors with different lenses in a camera or in a phone, you know, cost effectively and having it, you know, physically fit in there. It's more than double the size in the camera arrangement than a single camera. So, and they still made the choice that this is a feature that they want to, you know, talk about and promote heavily because people use it. This could be something that, you know, it gets down to a price where manufacturers could make this a feature, perhaps.
But I just can't get away from the one thing that Apple does so well, and that's one company makes one phone. You don't have three different models with different lenses snapped into the back. And it's, you know, Samsung, that's the one thing they do that just kills me. They make one really great phone and they make a whole bunch of other mediocre phones instead of just one mediocre phone. That's insane. Apple has that right because it makes it so much easier for them to support the products that they build. And when you start making... oh, well, we'll sell a version with this in the back embedded, and that's cool for the percentage of the people that want it, but it's not good for the company. It's not good for their hardware ecosystem. It makes it too difficult.
Yeah, so interestingly, bringing it back to the Galaxy S8, Daniel was mentioning that he has a Galaxy A5 2017, I believe, and you know, that's a phone that the Galaxy A series and the Galaxy J series together – I would expect they're going to outsell the Galaxy S8 by 5 times, something like that, maybe. It's definitely going to outsell the Galaxy S8 Plus by an extreme margin. You know, obviously, that Galaxy S5, 6, 7, 8 are like the big-time sellers. And even they are not going to push the numbers that, you know, these lower-end models, of which the Galaxy A5, you know, A series and J series are at least three different phones with different SKUs in different areas. So, obviously, we talk about the Galaxy S8, but, you know, volume-wise, there are all these other phones. And, you know, what kind of emphasis is being put on the cameras in the Galaxy J7? I mean, nothing like this.
No.
Well, I mean, that comes back to Sony. When I think about a company that really emphasizes camera performance on its mid-range products, I'd argue that, you know, after using the high-end phones for so long and being disappointed, they essentially use those high-end phones as ways to beta test the camera experiences that come to the mid-range lines the next year. So, yeah. For example, in addition to the Sony Xperia XZS and XZ Premium announcements at MWC, the company announced the XA1 and XA1 Premium. And the cameras inside both of those mid-range phones, which will probably go for $250, $300, are the same ones in the Z3 and Z3 Plus, which were very close to the ones in the Z5 and Z5 Premium. So
my point there really quickly is Sony has said that the XA was their most popular phone, at least in the US, of any recent release by a wide margin. So the XA and XA Ultra, I guess, the gigantic one, which sell for $250 to $350, like that's, again, where the volume is. So having a two-year-old camera in it is fine, or two generations old, whatever you want to say for Sony, is fine. Because interestingly, that's a way better camera than you're going to get from any other phone for $300.
And they know that cameras sell phones these days.
Right.
So, I mean, increasingly, the Galaxy S8 is going to have a great camera, but the Galaxy A5, which sells for $300 US or whatever, has a 16 megapixel sensor with an f1.9 lens, which is essentially a Galaxy S6. So,
which is a decent camera.
Yeah, it's great.
And Dan, that phone, you have it there on your desk. It's wonderful. It's built beautifully, isn't it?
Well, it's essentially a Galaxy S7. So it's got the same build as the S7 with slightly pared down specs.
And what software is on it?
Well, it's funny you asked that because it's got the latest version of Android. I think it's called Marshmallow.
Yeah. And maybe, just maybe, if Samsung didn't make six other Galaxy A's, that phone would have the same software as their next Note will, or, you know, their next Galaxy S. And if it did, that would be so much easier on the guys writing software.
Yeah, it's pretty inexcusable that this ships with Marshmallow, I have to be honest. Okay, so let's go back to the S8. So we've heard a lot of we've seen the phone so many times and we've heard a lot about it. So Russell, are you keeping up with the rumors? Are you eating them up like we are?
Yeah, I mean, I keep a pretty weather eye on them. I gotta say, one of the cool things has been the leaked photos. I wind up being such a hypocrite when I see the Samsung phones because every other manufacturer, I'm like, man, I would really love to see, you know, a brightly colored version of this phone. You know, like I love the colors on like the Nexbit Robin or the Blue Pixel and, you know, things like that. I love phone manufacturers that double out in colors and kind of show those versions off. And Samsung did it for a while, even though the cool colors never made it to the U.S., still pretty bitter about that emerald green one, Samsung. Yeah, I gotta say that like straight up murdered out S8 that shows up in all of the leaked photos. It, you know, in very much the same way that the all black Note 7, mm-hmm. you know, like really just kind of grabbed my attention. And I was like, man, this is a phone like I genuinely enjoy holding and touching and using. It just looks really nice. I feel the exact same way towards that phone. Like, don't even bother showing me other colors. The straight up all black version of the S8 is the one that I want. I don't even need to see the other ones.
Looks like the paint's wet. I love it.
You're not.
Yeah, it just looks so good.
You're not jonesing for the amethyst version?
I'm not. Like, and you know, good on them for going for other colors. You know what it really comes down to for me on this phone in particular? It's the cutouts on the front of the phone. And I wrote about this a little while ago, and I got yelled at quite a bit for it. But, you know, you look up, there's no bezel on the front of this phone anymore. Samsung has just eliminated so much of the bezel on this phone so that you have to put all of the sensors at the top of this phone all next to each other. And then that's what they do. And so you look at like the silver S8, and you get up there, and you know there's now a you know camera cutout and a speaker cutout and the laser cutout for the autofocus and the light ambient light sensor, and now a separate cutout for the retina scanner. And so you just you get this little strip of silver with all of these weird uneven holes punched in it, where you know they line up in a straight line, but none of them are the same size.
Paul Renee.
Yeah. I wish that they would just go with that black color on the front of all of them, because I feel the same way about the G6, where it's like there's a really small bezel, and when you look at the silver one, whatever it's called, platinum, something like that. Yeah, platinum. It's the same thing, except for there aren't, you know, the GS8 has like three more holes in probably a smaller bezel, you know, plus the speaker up there.
But let's talk about why.
Why, which part of it?
Yeah, well, I mean, there must be a reason. Obviously, Samsung's just not putting holes in its phones for no reason.
There's a whole bunch of scanners that have to see daylight through glass. So you can't put black glass over top of them. It has to be clear.
And you can't put them on the bottom where your fingers will cover them. Right. So you have to – Russell gave a pretty good rundown there. It's you have front-facing camera, ambient light sensors, speaker, and the iris scanner, and those are the main ones. And then is there going to – and then there's – the front-facing camera is rather large as well. I think it's an 8-megapixel sensor and has autofocus. So – that's going to be pretty big. And then when you squeeze down, they all have to be closer together too. And so it kind of looks comical.
I want somebody to turn one on and put it in front of a webcam, a computer capture camera.
Oh, so you can just grab all of that IR light that's coming from it?
Yes, so we can see just what light is coming out and which ones put light out and which ones accept light.
That's how you get a phone that straight up looks like it came from the Borg Collective. Those are always fun.
Because we don't know exactly what's up there. We know what functions they need to do, but we don't know what sensors they're using yet. But there are a lot of them.
And it's I mean, this is why I've always been a fan of black fronts on phones, but Samsung has definitely seen great adoption of the platinum and gold Galaxy S7 range because, well, first of all, they're great about making them available everywhere. Mm-hmm. So you know, sorry, Russell, you didn't get the Air Moto Green one in the US. But as far as in each market, when they say you can get black, white, or gold, or black, platinum, or whatever, that's going to be everywhere within, you know, a month. You can go to whatever carrier, whatever retailer, get your size, your configuration, and your color, and that's awesome. So that definitely helps that they're not like limited edition type of things. I'm not sure how I haven't looked at what the carriers are doing with the G6, but the G6 doesn't have, I mean, the platinum is a little out there, but there's nothing out there. Like I'm looking at this photo of proposed GS8 colors and we're looking at, you know, gold, silver, that, you know, violet, amethyst, whatever, a blue, a white, a black. So, you know, there's nothing like that. So having kind of a wild color available everywhere, you know, you're going to find plenty of people that are going to buy that. And then, you know, that's a nice little marketing thing because that stands out big time, a bright gold, especially the back of these GS8s, because it's, you know, GS8 Plus especially is going to be huge. You know, that's marketing right there. That's the bright gold phone that you don't get anywhere else.
Oh, yeah. As soon as someone holds it up to their ear, it stands out, you know, stands out in a crowd.
Just Samsung, make a Nokia orange one, and I'll buy it.
So, Jerry, I have to ask, why can't Samsung combine the front-facing camera with the iris scanner camera? What is the technical reason why they can't be the same module?
Without actually seeing it or seeing the diagrams, I'm going to say that the iris / retina scanner uses a near IR cut filter over the glass. And you don't want that on a lens that's taking actual pictures because it's not in color anymore. It's in black and white.
Okay.
That's a guess. That's a wild guess.
But he's probably pretty close.
I am a machine vision engineer. That's what I did for a long time. I want to get a picture of something and very distinctly find the differences between colors that maybe my eye can't even see the difference. I would need to use an IR cut filter at a specific wavelength to try to determine one shade of green from 19 other shades of green in a human eye. So that's the easy way. I'm going to assume that Samsung's going the easy way.
All right.
And we'll hope that between the sensor and the software, they have made massive, extremely massive strides in speed from the Galaxy Note 7.
See, that's we're wrong. We are pressuring Samsung the wrong way. The faster you make it to unlock your phone, the less secure and
less
more
secure
worthless
it is.
Right. You're going to get to the point where you can fake it with a picture if you want it fast. And
that's not good. That's the thing. We should absolutely tell people that about it not being secure. But the thing is, if they want this to be a feature, they have to figure out how to make it one quarter of the time that the Note 7 did.
I don't know. I'm less interested in speed and more interested in it just working everywhere.
Yeah.
If I get the exact same experience when I'm in, you know, standing in complete sunlight, which is harder, I'm pretty sure, than making it fast.
Because you're all squinting your eyes going, get out of
right,
my eyes.
You know, so you know, but that's what I want. I want it to work everywhere exactly the same. You know, if the experience is consistent, that's way more important to me than speed.
I remember this moment where I was driving back from the Note 7 launch, and I had a Galaxy Note 7. They were passing one around in a car because I was with Samsung's PR team, and it was in a car, so the lighting was fine. Like it was a little bit low because the windows were tinted, but this should the iris scanner should have had no issue with picking up my eyes, and it didn't. It just could not verify who I was. And that was like a very easy situation. So there were just too many times where the iris scanner said, nope, sorry, can't do it. And everything else about the phone, other than the impending doom, but at the time we didn't know, everything else about the phone seemed so mature, and yet they included this iris scanner that seems so preliminary and so in beta.
I worry about security maybe too much. I know if they make that Alcatel Idol 3, I think it was, the first phone that came out with an iris scanner, it worked everywhere every time. It worked great, but it was so insecure I could fake it with – I faked it with crayons drawing on a white piece of paper. But nobody – if I get Russell's phone, I'm not going to try to draw a picture of his eyeball to unlock it. I know that. But they have to make it so it's secure enough for people that maybe are important enough that you would want to draw a picture of their eye. You know, if you've got – think of people out there, if you found their phone, what you'd like to see that's on their phone. Hopefully we have morals and we wouldn't do it, but there are a lot of people who would want to try to trick some people's phones, and that's what they have to combat against. So I don't know the answer. I get Russell's point, and I agree, because I had that Idol 4, and it was – or Idol 3, I think. It was fun to play with the iris scanner. It worked every time. But my side of it is how horribly insecure it is when you make it work every time and really fast.
Well, the nice thing is that just like the Note 7, a lot of people – okay – even if it is fast, so let's say they improve their speed by 75%, it's still going to be way, way, way faster to just place your finger on that fingerprint sensor, which, even though it is in an extremely awkward space, place, and it looks like it's going to be hard to reach, and they couldn't figure out under glass fingerprint sensing on the front in time, so they have to have the super awkward fingerprint sensor on the back, yada, yada, yada. Still going to be easier to reach back there and just touch that, and more secure.
Right.
And in the end, if you have, you know, if you're somebody that has a Samsung Knox enforced policy, security policy on your phone, they're never, ever, ever going to let you turn on facial recognition or iris recognition anyway. It's going to be a 15 character, you know, mixed password for you anyway.
And we're hearing different rumors from different people. Andrew was, we were talking before the podcast. there's rumor out there that Samsung Pay is going to allow you to use your face to unlock to pay with your phone. There's another – the Korea Herald was saying that the Samsung, because the fingerprint sensor is on the back and some people want to be able to use the phone without having to pick it up, the eye scanner facial recognition software is going to work in 1,000th of a second and not be your secure lock method. So it works every time instantly as soon as you look at it. We don't know until it gets here.
That's true. So we do know a couple of things. We know that between the April 7th release and the rumored April 28th release, April 7th release of the G6 and the rumored April 8th release of the GS8, there will be 3 weeks of sort of a vacuum, right, where everybody will have to decide, okay, I have these two phones. Do I wait for the Galaxy or do I go with the G6? Andrew, do you think that a lot of people are going to go with the G6 or they're just going to wait for the inevitably more, I guess, culturally important device?
Well, I think by default, LG just gets some free sales because people, I mean, the problem is normal people don't wait. I mean, for the most part, they don't wait. If they have a situation in which they walk into the carrier for some unrelated reason and the carrier says, oh, hey, you're available for an upgrade on your financing plan. And look, you could trade in this Galaxy S5 that you have, been holding on to forever and for some reason haven't upgraded. They're not going to say, oh, well, maybe you should wait a month to get the Galaxy S8. They're going to say, look at this shiny G6 that we have here. Look at this shiny iPhone that we have here as well. Let's be frank.
I want to take that step further. I've talked to a couple people that are pretty sure that the unveiling and availability for unlocked rest of world models is going to be April 28th, but the U.S. carriers is going to be 31 days after the G6, just so people can't take it back.
So what?
Well, so
people can't take the G6 back and get their money back to buy the S8. That really screws the carriers
from the carrier's perspective.
Right.
That's interesting.
So, I mean, we had already heard that Samsung's target was to release just about a week after their announcement, but that's already slipped by 2 or 3 weeks. And of course, the carriers can, they want to try to cut some deals to dictate when that goes out. So back to my original point, people, yes, the nerds will wait. They know what's coming. Your average person today, they're barely aware of the G6, let alone the GS8, which hasn't been announced. They're not following the rumors and the leaks in the same way. They're deciding, they're deciding a lot of times based on just what's available now. I need a phone.
Yep.
If you have a broken phone or the carrier is offering you a great incentive on a phone or you're upgrading lines or you're moving 3 or 4 people, you're not going to say, hey, why don't we wait another complete billing cycle to switch and then, get the new phone. So LG by default is going to win that battle because it's the only one playing for about a month. But after that point, Samsung's, in the open market where people have the two choices side by side, that's when Samsung just makes up all the coverage because the carriers know that selling a Samsung phone to somebody is more of a sure thing than, yes, even after the Note 7 situation. They know it's more of a sure thing hit with the consumer than trying to sell them on something which is more likely to be different in the G6.
Absolutely.
And that's just comes down to marketing. It comes down to what the carrier wants to sell. I'm happy to see that, it looks like LG is going to sell unlocked in the US through B&H. That'll be awesome for the nerds. But, again, that's such a small portion of it. The big thing is Samsung's going to stock these carriers very, very well. And you're going to be able to go in and get, that thing that you heard about on that, you know, the Samsung ads that they're running during March Madness or, you know, everything else.
Right, because there's a problem with the way other companies market their phones. If you buy a G6 and it's great and it does everything and you love it, there's a good chance you're still going to regret buying it when you see what all this marketing tells you about the S8. That's a problem that other companies have to overcome because Samsung's doing it right. So, anything that helps, I guess LG is really lucky that they got it out a month early. That's sales that they may not have gotten head to head.
I mean, and of course, you're looking at, especially if you look at something like Verizon, the G6 will be on sale. I mean, sure, it's pre-orders now, but you're looking at 2 weeks of pre-orders before the GS8's even announced.
Yep.
And another 4 weeks of sales before the GS8 is on sale. That's just by default things, you know, this was kind of LG's goal, get out the door yep. before Samsung. And if Samsung slips at all, that's more free sales to LG. Now, again, this is all in relative terms. Samsung is going to outsell LG, you know, flagship to flagship 100 times over. But
maybe not,
you know, to LG, it means a lot more to LG to get those extra 6 weeks of sales than it means to Samsung to lose them.
Right. At this point, LG just needs to be in the black. You know, they need to just
they're
actually
not there yet,
make
but they're
money.
Working on it.
Right. When they can make money from their phone division, then they can try to expand that. But you fight Samsung, that's a tough battle for any company.
Well, it's also, you know, there's something to be said for how Samsung gives its former flagships a second life when their new phones come out. So the GS7 is going to be discounted $300, $400 eventually. Yep. And that phone will sell in the millions long into 2018. And
yeah,
you
the GS7 will outsell the G6 easily. I mean, it's already on sale by $250, $300 now, and the GS8 hasn't come out. Look at when you go to Boost Mobile in 2 months or Metro PCS.
And you can find a Galaxy S5.
Well, yeah, you find a Galaxy S5 today, but you'll find a GS7 for $400, and that's going to be massive for them. Buying on Metro PCS or whatever.
Right. If you, when you find a GS7 for $450, $400, you buy it because that's a huge, incredible bargain. That's a better right. buy than buying a brand new G6 or Galaxy S8. Let's be honest, it is.
That's why they'll sell.
All right. Let's talk about a phone that you won't find anywhere near a carrier store and a phone that is arguably $200 to $300 too expensive. We're talking about the HTC U Ultra. This is a phone that was announced a couple of days after CES ended and is only now shipping to consumers.
2 months later.
Andrew got one, and he is putting together his thoughts on it. But give us a summary.
So hearing Russell talk about all of those colors of the GS8 and how he loves them, it just makes me think that he would love the blue HTC U Ultra. Just to look at.
Oh, it's so pretty.
Yeah, not to use, but just to look at. It is.
don't touch it. Just stare at it behind, like, glass.
When Jerry said that it looks like the paint is still wet, like, that is the epitome of what you can call this phone. In black or blue, the white one, not so much, but in black or blue, it looks like it's just, like, surface tension holding liquid inside a frame. And it's absolutely amazing. It looks very HTC, you know, it doesn't look like Samsung or LG or Huawei or anybody else made this phone. It very much looks HTC, and that's awesome because HTC still makes very beautiful phones, and the rest of it is, of course, perfectly made, and the, you know, the glass on the front is perfect, and the screen is great. They really nail all of the basics. The problem is the rest of the phone that you actually use is just not... It's not up to the standards that we're talking about here, which is $749 unlocked. You know, we just got done talking about how the G6 is maybe a bit overpriced considering the GS8. This thing is absolutely overpriced considering that the GS8 and the G6 exist. This would, the U Ultra would be very well positioned to compete in like the mid $500 range, which is where the lower end sibling to this, the Uplay, is competing with vastly inferior specs in a smaller size, which is very interesting. So if they were to just knock both phones down by $200, you know, and lose even more money, which they don't want to do, that's what they would have to do. But anyway, it's a massive phone. I was trying to explain to Jerry how big it is, but it's bigger than the LG V20. It's bigger than the Huawei Mate 9. And if you've held either one of those phones, you know that that is very wide, very tall, and very heavy. So it's 80 millimeters wide, 163 millimeters tall, and it weighs like 175 grams. So the thing is a paperweight, and it's tougher to hold on to than most phones. All for, you know, it's Snapdragon 821, 4 gigs of RAM, 64 gigs of storage, normal stuff there. It's a 5.7-inch screen that, like I said, looks really good, but it's, you know, just a quad HD 5.7-inch LCD. There's nothing special that necessitates this to be a gigantic phone with big bezels. And it has this little secondary display. It is actually just a direct clone of the V20's display, which I wasn't a fan of that design either. And, you know, even though it's this huge phone, it has a 3,000 milliamp hour battery. So not that big a battery either. It can make it through a day, but it's not going to be, you know, we're looking, you know, this is 10% smaller battery than is in the G6 and is like 500 milliamp hours smaller than what we're expecting in the Galaxy S8 Plus. You know, there's basically no reason for this phone to be so huge. And that's one of its biggest detractions, is that, you know, they made it huge and added the second display, but then they didn't fill the internal space with anything, including not having a headphone jack. So that's fun.
Yeah.
You're bumming me out, Martinik.
I mean, this definitely feels like a 2016 phone.
Yeah, absolutely.
Released in 2017.
But there's one thing, though, that we need to... We say it's overpriced. You shouldn't buy it. You can get better phones for this price. You can't argue with that. But there's also that it costs that much because of the way it's built. If you phones built... You know, that phone, from what I understand, I've never held it. But Andrew has one, and I've talked to him, and there's somebody else I know that has one, a white one. And it the way it's built is typical HTC. Every seam is perfect. The metal has zero blemishes in it. It's gorgeous. It's absolutely perfect. The bevels on the glass where they're cut, if you look at them with a magnifying lens, they're perfect. Everything is engineered and manufactured to super high tolerances. That costs a lot of money. Should HTC stop building stuff this nice?
I think the issue is not necessarily the price. I think that the, like you said, the build of materials is perfect. HTC still does a damn good job making really high-end phones, and it even carries that down into the desire type phones, you know, made out of plastic and, you know, different kinds of metals, things like that. They make great phones. The problem is you make a lot of stupid mistakes elsewhere in the phone, and it makes it really hard to justify spending $750 just to get the pretty hardware. You know what I mean?
I agree. That's what I said. You can't say that we're wrong when we say you shouldn't spend this much because you can get a better phone for this price. I just wonder, you know, if HTC needs a phone to compete with that Galaxy A that Daniel has, should they stop making them so well and make $450 phones instead?
Right.
It's going in the other direction. HTC said that it doesn't want to make cheap Desire phones anymore, right, because they aren't selling in volume enough to make them money. So, I mean, here's the thing, right? If the BOM is like $200, right, and they're selling it for $750, they're making a ton of money off each device. Even if they only sell 50,000 of them, that's a small profit for a company that has a balance sheet that shows revenue dropping quarter over quarter for the last 3 years. It's barely making a profit, right? So this is a company that used to sell over $1 billion in revenue a quarter, and now is down to like $300 million. And it's a publicly traded company, so it needs to prove to its shareholders that there are that it can make money. Period.
Their issue was that, like you said, in the cheap market, they still had their standards were too high to make cheap phones. No matter how cheap you make a phone, you can't make it cheaper than Huawei. You can't make it cheaper than ZTE. You can't make it, that cheaply.
You can't make it cheaper than Samsung. Let's be honest.
Being good enough to, sell the phone still. So HTC, their problem was they were selling $250 phones for $350. They weren't, that was as low as they could go. And now the problem is, so getting back to the U Ultra on the very high end, which is as high as there, as you can go, basically, for a base model, 750, is they're still making the same dumb HTC decisions. Like I said, this second screen, it makes no sense at all, but it adds to the size and cost of the phone, and they had to develop software to go on it that is useless. The phone doesn't have a headphone jack. It's like people are not flocking to buy HTC phones, and you're still taking away from that subset of people that enjoy the design and the, frankly, extremely fast performance of the software on the phone and the great fingerprint sensor. And, the camera is pretty good, but not, top end. But you're making stupid decisions like putting the second screen on there, making it a gigantic phone, but not having a big battery in it, taking away, not having waterproofing, not having a headphone jack. All of this stuff adds up to you're making really dumb decisions, but you're still trying to sell the phone for $750. I have no problem with HTC trying to sell a phone for $750. It just has to be overall, all around good phone, because everybody else is killing you at this price. And if this is going to be your focus, you have to do it right.
Maybe my question is, we assume that they're going to make a successor to the HTC 10.
Yes.
That's going to be their quote unquote flagship line for the year. So why even make the Bolt? Or they're not the Bolt. That's what it reminds me of. The U Ultra. Why? If they want to say that that's a high-end phone, it's not as good as their next high-end phone is going to be, and it's overpriced. Why do they do it?
That's the interesting thing. It was part of it you have to understand is this was very much an Asia-focused device that they happened to bring to the U.S. and Western Europe.
Okay.
And it's part of this two-pronged strategy where they're going to sell a very reasonable number of U plays, which are landing more in like the low 500 range and don't have the second display, are smaller and have a MediaTek processor in them that's way more accepted there.
Mm-hmm.
So it's part of a 1-2 punch there. And we saw the launch event was in Taipei. It came out in Taiwan like a month ago, even though it's not technically sold in the U.S., it's still pre-orders in the U.S. today. And I think the bigger thing from Daniel's point there of having, a large margin, even if you're not going to sell many of them, the backside of that is HTC is spending roughly $0 on marketing in the U.S. Their marketing is social media and sending out review units, which we love to see and use, and selling it unlocked directly to consumers where they already operate the channels, they already operate the customer service. So the marginal cost increase of selling additional phones in the U.S. is very, very, very small, as long as you're not spending hundreds of millions of dollars on marketing with, big ads in Times Square and TV spots during the Super Bowl and stuff like that. So it is an option. If they're already going to make this phone, they're say, hey, it's worth $750, take it or leave it. As long as they're not spending a lot of money to try and sell it, then yeah, it can be a revenue positive move. But okay, that's short term. I mean, this is,
well, it's
no matter how many of these, well, it's better than, so, yeah, it's better than the 1M9.
My thing is just was absolute confusion. So any reason is a better reason than what the hell are you doing? I don't know. I don't want to see HTC eventually have to fold. If you're an Android fan, you have HTC to thank for it. And I want this company to be around a long time.
So I think my final point there is that it still makes sense for HTC to sell phones, even flawed, expensive phones like the U Ultra in the US, because it doesn't cost them basically anything to sell it. And so everything that, if they know that they're going to make $300 a phone or whatever, I mean, just theoretical, say they know they're going to make $100 a phone all in, that's not going to change because they bring it to the US and sell it. You know what I mean? So if they know on a per unit basis, amortizing out all of the costs of support and sales and all that, that they're going to still make $100 a phone, why not do it? Now, it's the exact same story that we talked about with Sony selling phones without the fingerprint sensor, even though they have this dumb agreement. It's because they think in the future that it makes more sense to continue to sell phones even when nobody really wants them in good numbers, because it keeps the brand around and it doesn't cost them that much to continue to do it. And so hopefully this, the U Ultra being here for a little bit and selling 10,000 units or whatever, it doesn't cost them that much more, but it keeps HTC in the conversation for a little bit, at least on this podcast. I don't know if anybody else is talking about HTC until, you know, the successor to the HTC 10 comes out, which of course will have more of a position in the US.
And I'm sorry, I've had this question since the Bolt. Why? And I wanted to hear somebody's perspective on the answer. So I made this super long, and I'm sorry.
No, it's no problem at all.
We're contrasting arguably the two most popular Android phones in the US to a phone that is barely going to make a blip.
Yeah.
And they're all good phones, and that's so interesting that, you know, we can talk about HTC and in 2017 say that it really has zero impact on the US market, given that 6 years ago it was the number one OEM in the country. So, you know, it's sad for HTC, but the company is trying to reinvent itself, as Russell knows. He covers VR.
Yep.
At VR Heads, and the Vive is killing it. So, you know, they're pivoting.
I would feel worse for HTC not having good sales if their phones actually competed with the competition.
Yeah.
That's the downer.
Well, I think we're going to end it there. We were told last time that people love long podcasts, but we got to, you know, we got to go to bathrooms. So, you know, we're only human.
I have a review of the HTC U Ultra to write. So
he definitely
really
does.
I thought that you were going to say you have a review of a bathroom. Like, I really thought that's where you were going with that.
I put in a new shower head. I will review my bathroom. If anybody wants me to, I will.
It's the
Moen smart shower head.
The smart shower head.
No,
that was unveiled at CES.
Those things are just too expensive right now. It's just a regular shower head, but it's nice. It makes that rain thing, big round one.
Oh yeah,
those are really cool.
Now I want to go take a shower.
We're totally gonna do. We're just gonna do a bathroom podcast next.
So much echo.
I will podcast from the bathroom.
Stay tuned for 10 hours of bathroom podcast material.
Well, reporting from his bathroom, we'll start with you, Russell Hawley. Where can people find you on the internet?
I am always available at bathroomcentral.com. you can find me, Russell Hawley, anywhere. And if you're interested in Nintendo Switch stuff, take a look for some of the stuff I've been doing on iMore for that. If you're interested in any of my Android stuff, it all lives on Android Central, including that new, we didn't talk about it at all, that new app that I talked about earlier today called Supersonic. It's actually kind of a neat little messaging app that I've been using way more than I thought I was going to. So if you want to try Supersonic, hit me up. I am Russell Hawley on that as well. And then, of course,
no, you didn't.
All my VR stuff is on VR Heads. I put it on the website, and I think I have like 200 friend requests now on Supersonic for people who got it from AC and have been trying it out. Only two people so far have sent me messages that were either violent or sexual. So, two out of 200 isn't bad, guys. Keep it up.
Jerry, where can people find you to send dirty, dirty messages?
Oh, yeah. Send me dirty messages at, I'm on Twitter, at GB Hill, GBHIL. That's a weird name, but that's my name. I've also got this thing in the forums called Ask Jerry, and I have to apologize because the past 3 weeks or so, you guys know, I've been really busy. I've been reviewing a bunch of odd products like routers and stuff. And I haven't been giving that the attention that I should, but that's going to change. I'm getting some more free time for this kind of stuff in the very near future. But that and AndroidCentral.com or WindowsCentral.com, even iMore.com sometimes, you'll find me lurking around making words.
And Andrew, what about you?
Please don't send me your dirty photos in any way. Twitter or otherwise, or Supersonic or whatever that thing was called. That's not my thing. But I am on Twitter. You can talk to me about anything. Just, you know, keep the photos to a bare minimum, please.
The only balls that you send to Andrew are soccer balls.
Yeah, that's
Don't send him any other kind of balls.
To be fair, if you follow me at Andrew Martinick on Twitter, it's about 90% soccer related content and 9% Android, and then 1% other things.
It's awesome to see Andrew send out a tweet and it's 95% of things I don't understand and then a bunch of swearing. That means I know he's talking about soccer.
That's accurate. Yeah. Yes, correct.
And they're always appropriately hashtagged, which I appreciate.
You got to stay in the conversation, Daniel.
I don't know anything about MLS, and except for the fact that your team beat my team, and that's why we can never be friends.
That's really all that matters, yeah.
Well, that's it. My name is Daniel Bader. You can find me at Journey Dan on all the things. You can find us all at Android Central, and please, please leave a comment in the post on the site. Because we want to know what you want to hear in future episodes. We play it by ear based on what's out there in the news. But I think we did really well last week with the themed post. We got a lot of good feedback about cutting the cord. So we'd like to hear what other themed podcast episodes you would like to hear.
Not actually bathrooms, though, because I don't know enough about that stuff. I actually have to call a plumber later because I'm so bad at bathrooms.
All right. Well, we will see you next week. Hear you next week.
I guess my plumber could come on the podcast.
Oh, heck yeah.
No.
Plumber Central.
His hourly is way too high. Please do not bring him on the podcast.
He's definitely true. Ask him way too much.
I'll just follow behind him with a microphone while he fixes stuff.
Bye.
Bye-bye.